I'm sure we've all heard the phrase, you can never have too much of a good thing. And I'm sure we all realize that's just simply not true. Just think of a buffet, right? Case closed. It is possible to have too much of a good thing. Last week, as I prepared for the evening sermon on Abraham's greatest test of his faith, I ran into that very problem. I had way too much good material to fit into one message. And after the service, a few of you asked if I planned on continuing the message. At that time, I honestly answered no, because I hadn't even considered it. But the more I thought about it, the more I felt the Lord leading me to continue and to complete that message, which was entitled, Faith Willing. So let's return to that text, Hebrews chapter 11, verses 17 through 19. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead. Figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. Now, without question, the primary character of this paragraph is Abraham, who is called to sacrifice his son Isaac as a burnt offering to the Lord. But one commentator writes, both father and son stand revealed with special clarity at this supreme moment. Warren Wiersbe adds, we must not ignore the obedient faith of Isaac. Yet we do. Very rarely do we hear much about Isaac. We pass over his role in this story. And I think there's a couple of reasons. The first is a very common misconception. For many of us, when we're first hear that story, maybe it was in Sunday school or children's church. Maybe it was even in a Sunday morning service where the passage is being preached. We tend to think of Abraham leading little boy Isaac up the hill, right? You've got this little lad, maybe 3 or 4 years old, scampering beside his daddy as the old man trudges up the hill. But a little boy wouldn't be able to carry enough wood for a burnt offering. Isaac was no little boy here. He would have been grown. He was probably an adult. We're not given an age. I saw everything from late teens to mid-30s. I don't know where they get those numbers. It might just be a guess. But we certainly know that Isaac was old enough that he would have carried pretty good amount of wood up that mountain for the sacrifice. And the problem is this, if we think of Isaac as a helpless little victim, then we don't see his cooperation. We feel like he didn't have a choice. You know, they got up to the top of the hill and he asks the question, you know, where's the animal for the sacrifice? And Abraham just kind of pats him on the head and says, it'll be all right, God will provide. And then they build the altar, and all of a sudden, Abraham grabs his little boy, and we might think of the little boy struggling and kicking a little bit, and he ties him up and puts him up on the altar. That's not what happened at all. Isaac would have been old enough that he would have understood what was happening and probably could have resisted. Remember, you know, Abraham's well over 100 years old at this time. And even if he was in his late teens or in his 20s, physically, he probably could have overpowered Abraham at that point. He had to be willingly cooperative in this whole venture. I think the second reason we tend to ignore Isaac has to do with his personality. Isaac was the son of a famous father, and he was the father of a famous son. But he himself didn't seem to have the luster. His personality doesn't shine quite like Abraham or his son Jacob. Few people realize this, but Isaac lived 180 years, which was longer than both his father and his son. Yet those years weren't all that eventful. One classic writer says, Abraham is more interesting than Isaac, and Jacob is more interesting than Isaac to us, but not to God. Now, Isaac was not ignored by the Jewish writers around the time of Christ. In the apocryphal book of 4th Maccabees, as well as some other rabbinic writings, Isaac's willingness to be sacrificed was commended. So they understood his role in this whole event. But the author of Hebrews doesn't mention it here. Now, he does devote verse 20 to Isaac, and we're going to look at that next week. And down through the years, Isaac's willing faith has been largely overlooked. But tonight, I'd like to consider three aspects of faith that his willing spirit demonstrates. First of all, Isaac's willingness displays a parental faith. As Bob Russell, the longtime pastor of Southeast Christian Church in Louisville, Kentucky, writes in his book, Find Us Faithful, the story of Abraham and Isaac provides an excellent example of a father demonstrating priorities and passing the baton of faith on to the next generation. Now, we all know about the faith of Abraham. We've been studying it in this very series for the last three Sunday evenings. But what you see is that faith now displayed in his son. And while at first you might think that should be expected, think again to your own experience. How often do we see men and women that we hold up as great examples of faithfulness to God, but it's not seen in their children? I hope none of you fit into this category or get offended, but pastors' kids have a really bad reputation, don't they? Right? And some missionaries' kids. When I went to Bible college, some of the rowdiest students we had were either pastors' kids or missionaries' kids. And you might not expect that to be the case, but oftentimes it is. And I'm sure that Isaac didn't learn his faith on the way up the mountain that morning. It didn't just all of a sudden come to him. This is a faith that had been cultivated over the years, thanks to a father that modeled it often. You know, even though the Ten Commandments hadn't been established and wouldn't be for several hundred years when this all took place, Abraham obeyed the first commandment. What's the first commandment? You shall have no other God before me. Now, we tend to think of idolatry as a sin of the ancient world, you know, or maybe in some remote, uncivilized corner of the globe today. I mean, you think, who bows down to a statue today? I mean, not even the unbelievers in the world do that in our culture. And yet, we read in 1 John 5:21, the very last verse in the letter of 1 John, "Dear children, keep yourself from idols." That's a New Testament letter. In fact, it's one of the last ones written. And it's something that does echo down to our own day and age. Actually, I think the Living Bible's paraphrase brings it closer to home. Dear children, keep away from anything that might take God's place in your heart. Ooh. Yeah, that sounds a little bit more relevant. Keep yourself from idols. Okay, I won't bow down to any statue. Keep away from anything that'll take God's place in your heart. That can be just about anything. That can be a relationship. That can be a career. That can be a house or a car or some prized possession that we have. Anything or anyone can become an idol if it takes God's rightful place in our hearts. And as we noted last week, the more beautiful a thing is, the more capacity it has to become an idol. The more we fear losing it, the more likely we are to worship it. C.S. Lewis illustrated this in a book called The Great Divorce. Now, from the title, you'd think it's about the end of a marriage, and it's not about that at all. It examines why people choose for or against giving their lives in full commitment to God. He shows this by illustrating it. There's a busload of people that arrive at the pearly gates, and they have to choose between the eternal glory of God or the empty illusions of earth, what he calls the great divorce between earth and heaven. And the way Lewis writes this, and by the way, he's not making a theological statement. He's not suggesting that people can choose after they die whether or not they're going to heaven. This is kind of an extended parable. But there's a busload of people that have finished their earthly lives, and they're dropped off at a kind of a way station in which they will make their decisions about eternity. For each newcomer, there's a bright, shiny figure who steps out of heaven to receive his or her old friend and to encourage them to go on all the way to heaven. These aren't angels. These are rather acquaintances that they had on earth of people who were saved. Family members, friends, whoever it might be. One example is a woman named Pam. And she's disappointed that she doesn't see her son Michael meeting her, but rather it's her brother Reginald. See, Michael was a young son who died early. And Pam had devoted her entire life to her son. And even after he was gone, she devoted her life to his memory. Now, Reginald explains to Pam that she isn't ready for heaven yet. She must be first eager to see God himself. And then all the other wonderful blessings of heaven will be available. He tries to explain to her that God isn't just a way to get to heaven. Heaven is a way to get to God. And Pam needs to approach it that way. Reginald tells her, "I'm afraid the first step is a hard one. But after that, you'll go like a house on fire when you learn to want somebody else besides Michael." Well, Pam doesn't quite get it at first. She says, whatever. I'll do whatever's necessary. The sooner I begin it, the sooner they'll let me see my boy. And her brother says, "You don't get it, do you? You're treating God as only a means to get to Michael. She must learn first that God must be first in her life. She must want God for his own sake. He can't come second in her affections. In fact, he can't even be tied for first." Reginald goes on to say, "You exist as Michael's mother only because you exist first as God's creation. That relation is older and closer. See, human beings can't make one another really happy for long. You can't love a fellow creature fully until you love God." And it becomes clear that Pam's love for her son was really something of an obsession in her life. After he died, she kept his room just as he had left it for 10 years. She neglected all of her other children, her husband, her parents, to the pain and disappointment of them all. This was all sacrificed on the altar of her adoration for her son. Pam says to Reginald, "No one has the right to come between me and my son, not even God." And that's the decision she makes. See, in Lewis's view, it's not so much that God won't let us into heaven. We don't allow ourselves into heaven. If we can't learn to say, "Thy will be done," God eventually will say, "Okay, your will be done." And he lets us have the consequences of our choices. See, this mother had to find her primary love for God before she could have the kind of love she needed for her son or anybody else. But as things stood, she took something beautiful, that precious boy, and she had turned it into an ugly idol. And it distorted all the other relationships. You say, "But how can you tell the mother of a child to love that child less?" We're not talking about loving a child less. We're talking about loving God more. And when you love God more, you'll love your children better. And your spouse and everybody else involved in your life. See, there was a message. There was a lesson that Isaac learned on that mountain that day. That Abraham's faith in God was the foremost priority in his life. Isaac knew he was loved. But on that day, Abraham demonstrated that he loved God even more than he loved Isaac. And I wonder if maybe that's why Isaac did not rebel against his father's faith. He didn't say, my dad's fanatic religion about cost me my life. I don't want anything to do with God. I don't want to put my children through what I've been through. No, Isaac embraced his father's faith. And it became the most important part of his life. And you know, until the younger generation senses that obedience to God is first in our life, that He is number one in our lives, they're probably going to object to all of our lectures and all of our sermons, and in turn, they're going to reject our values. I'm convinced that the reason why so many pastors' kids and missionaries' kids rebel against their parents' faith is because they've been sacrificed not on the altar to God, but on the altar to ministry, on the altar to other people's expectations. They don't see the true kind of faith Abraham had. And I think that's why so many of them reject it. Say, well, how do you do that practically speaking? I mean, that's all wonderful. But you know, God's probably not going to call me to sacrifice my son or daughter on an altar. How do I do that in my life today? Russell gives us three ways. Priorities are demonstrated by our attitude toward the church. What is our attitude toward church? Is it a come and go, take it or leave it? Well, if I don't have anything better to do, I guess I'll go to church. If that's our attitude, they're probably going to catch that too. And I know there's a lot of debates parents have about whether you should make your kids come to church. I believe you should, to a point. I believe that you should bring your children with you to church, whatever opportunities you can, as they are very young. There will come a time in their life when they will choose for themselves. And it doesn't matter if you do everything right, sometimes they're going to choose the other way. I'm not trying to set a guarantee here, but I think that when they see a true devotion to God and to His church, and that it's real, it's much more likely that's going to be passed on to the next generation. I look at my own parents as an example. They'll be the first ones to tell you they weren't perfect parents. They weren't even Christians until I was 3 years old, and by that time, my older brothers were, what, 9 and 10? Or 8 and 9? But they got into church, and they were devoted to God. And they took us to church. We were there twice on Sunday and every Wednesday and 3 or 4 times a week probably in between that. We were one of those families. We were there every time the door was open. And not one of us ever rebelled against it. We loved it. We wanted to be there. I don't ever remember my parents ever saying, come on kids, time to go to church. Oh, Dad, do we have to? We just didn't. We wanted to be there. Now, you might have to, you know, assert your will when they're early, but at least give them the opportunity so that when they do get old enough, they can make up their minds for themselves. And it is something that lasted. My brother's a missionary over in Germany. My other brother, at the time that he went home to be with the Lord, was a member of his church board and very active. And they've got another son that's a preacher. And we weren't going kicking and screaming. And I do believe, and my oldest brother affirms the same thing. We caught it from our parents. And it's not because they shoved it down our throat. We learned it, we respected it. Priorities are also demonstrated by the atmosphere created in the home. Do we live what we act on Sunday, Monday through Saturday? They'll see it. They'll see right through it if we're putting on a show Sundays. There was a song some time ago recorded. It was called Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Christian. On Sundays, we put on our Sunday best and give our language a Sunday rest. We look so good and sing the hymns, but boy, Monday through Saturday, it's a whole other person. God's not fooled. Let me tell you something. Your kids aren't either. They'll see it. And then finally, priorities are demonstrated by our adherence to God's commands. Whether we're home, at work, at church, driving on the roads, whatever it might be, do we live it? Isaac saw in his father not perfect faith. No, we saw that. Abraham and Sarah were far from perfect people. And I'm thankful the Bible presents them warts and all. They don't try to cover up those times when they flat out blew it. But Isaac saw Abraham's consistent, willing faith, and he adopted it as his own. There is more to it than parental faith, though. Isaac's willingness displays a personal faith as well. It's like the old saying goes, God has no grandchildren. No one's going to heaven because their parents were faithful. They must have a personal faith of their own. Now, how do we see Isaac's personal faith displayed? By his willingness to be bound and laid on that altar by his father. As we said, this is no little boy that didn't have a choice. But he willingly submitted himself. As one classic author puts it, in this case, we cannot say that the superior strength of the father prevailed, but the faithful obedience of the son yielded. Isaac got on that altar because Isaac was willing to be put there. He wasn't forced up Mount Moriah, dragged in chains, struggling and resisting. Here you see a full-grown man with a mind and a will of his own submitting to his father's will. Sound familiar? There are a lot of parallels between this story and Jesus. We said last week Mount Moriah changed names over the years. By the time of the first century, it was called Mount Calvary. That same hill on which Isaac would have been sacrificed, Jesus was. And just like Isaac carried the wood for the sacrifice, Jesus carried his cross. The only difference was, when Abraham took the knife and was ready to plunge it into his son, God said, stop. But when the hammer was raised to pound those spikes through Jesus' hands and feet, there was no voice from heaven that said, stop. But just because Isaac was spared doesn't make his faith any less willing. God honored that. Finally, Isaac's willingness displays a practical faith. This isn't just some good, mushy feeling. This is no theory that could be debated. This wasn't a religious performance for an hour or so a week. James writes, faith without works is dead. And I think Isaac's faith certainly rates as a living faith. Now, we might be tempted to think that Isaac's faith is inactive, since it's measured not so much by what he accomplishes, but by what he allows. But even in this way, Isaac comes really into his own, not by how he succeeds, but by how he suffers. And oftentimes, that is the true measurement of our faith. It's not how great we are. It's not our wonderful successes. What do we suffer? Think of Jesus himself. He was not a man of success. He was a man of sorrows. And oftentimes our faith is seen brightest in those times of suffering. Major Ian Thomas writes, willingness to die is the price you must pay if you want to be raised from the dead and live and work and walk in the power of God, sharing the resurrection life of Jesus Christ on earth. In this, you are identified with Him in the relentless unfolding of God's redemptive purposes, which are to find their final consummation in the glorious appearing of our triumphant Lord. See, God is not going to call all of us to die. But are we willing? You know, we honor as heroic those who lay down their lives for others, whether it's in the field of battle, in the line of duty, or maybe even a passerby trying to save a stranger at the risk of losing his or her own life. Now, one trait all of these folks have in common is that at that critical moment, they're not afraid to die. Some, in fact, do die. Others do not. Now, that doesn't make the one's heroism greater than the other. It is the willingness to die that is honored. And I think that Isaac's quiet obedience to his father illustrates that beautifully. He gave himself over to his father's will and allowed himself to be placed on that altar without a fight. He didn't fear death. And you know, the more our faith grows, we're not going to fear death either. We're going to be able, like Paul, to look death in the eye and say, you know what, either way I win. I'm in a no-lose situation, death. You can take me and I'm going to be with the Lord. And if you don't, God's got something for me to do here. I win either way. You know how much stress that relieves off a person? When whether you live or die, you're in the Lord's hands. What's there to worry about? It's amazing how liberating that is when we can get to that point. You know, I think in some ways it's easier to die for our faith than it is to live in it. Death only comes once. And then for the Christian, we're with the Lord. But living our faith is so daily. I mean, every day we got to fight the same old fights and dethrone self and make sure God has allowed full control. We got to resist Satan's temptations to sin. Every day is a new battle. And I think that's why Jesus, when he said, "You must take up your cross to follow me," he adds in there, "You must die daily." It's not just a once-for-all type of a thing. But that's what faith is all about. That whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. I'd like to close tonight with a prayer. I don't usually read somebody else's prayer, but I think this was very appropriate. It's by A.W. Tozer. It's found in his classic book, The Pursuit of God. So if you'll bow with me, I'd like to close our service tonight with this prayer. Father, I want to know you, but my coward heart fears to give up its toys. I can't part with them without inward bleeding, and I don't try to hide from you the terror of this parting. I come trembling, but I do come. Please root out from my heart all those things that I have cherished so long and which have become a very part of myself, so that you may enter and dwell there without rival. Then will you take the place of first in my life. Then will my heart have no need of the sun to shine on it, for you will be my light, and there will be no night there. In Jesus' name, amen. We're done.